Welcome to MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. The reconstruction of the Ninth Ward in the city of New Orleans has been a slow, painstaking, and in some ways painful process ever since it was devastated by Hurricane Katrina in 2005. But a young man is helping to rebuild a little bit of the Ninth Ward and several hundred lives. His name is Brian Bordenick, and he's going to be the speaker at the 20th Annual Tennessee Undergraduate Social Science Symposium here at MTSU on Tuesday, November the 1st in the James Union Buildings, Tennessee room at 6 p.m. It's free and open to the public, of course. And we'll talk to Brian Bordenick from New Orleans via telephone right after we hear these words via MTSUnews.com.
Here are a few of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. Dr. Jim Calder, MTSU professor in the Department of Elementary and Special Education, recently was nominated to serve as a Board of Examiners member for the National Council for Accreditation of Teacher Education. Calder was nominated by the National Education Association, and after going through an intensive training program, will serve a three-year term. The MTSU Student Union, currently under construction, is expected to be ready for occupancy in the summer of 2012. The building will feature a new food court, bookstore, and a ballroom with a seating capacity of 850 patrons. And the construction of a new women's basketball office suite will also soon be completed, as the result of a generous gift by alumnus Ken Shipp. A formal ribbon cutting will be held sometime before the end of the year. For MTSU News Anytime, go to MTSUnews.com.
Brian Bordenick on the phone from somewhere in New Orleans. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And you graduated from the University of Georgia in 2007. How did you learn that your assignment was going to be George Washington Carver High School in the New Orleans Ninth Ward?
I was actually there the year that the Recovery School District opened back up, and they were basically guesstimating on how many people they would need in different schools based on a population that was consistently coming back, but they didn't know. So I was at a school, and they decided a week before school not to open it. And then I was at another school, and they decided they didn't need half the staff, so they redispersed us to other parts of the city. So I learned actually 24 hours before the start of school where I would be teaching. And I didn't learn what I was teaching until about 45 minutes into my first period class. Teach for America does alternative certification programs to make sure that the people that they're placing in schools meet all of the state and federal requirements to be a teacher.
You're talking about teaching kids who have been living out of FEMA trailers for a long time, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're very, they varied in terms of displacement. Some went to Houston and went to school in Houston. Others went to Atlanta, Tennessee, other places, and actually were in school. Others stayed and didn't go to school. Families were split up. It ran the gauntlet in terms of, like, the needs and what actually happened to some of these kids immediately following the storm. But, yeah, I was actually 21 when I first started teaching. I just was about to turn 22, and I had kids in my class, one or two of them, that were 20 years old.
And predominantly an African-American school population, right?
Correct. The Recovery School District is actually the most segregated school system in the country. It's, I believe, right now it's getting more integrated, but when it opened up, it was 98 or 99% African-American and almost 88 or 90% free and reduced lunch.
It's my understanding that back in the day, during the days of legally enforced segregation, that Carver had really kick-ass athletic teams, right?
That's absolutely, yeah, that's true. Marshall Faulk is a graduate of the school. And in terms of segregation, if you were African-American and you did not go to the school located in the heart of downtown, you went to Carver. So the school opened up in 1958, and there's a huge population of African-American people in the city of New Orleans that are of a certain age that have a very special love for this school and a lot of pride, for sure.
But after Katrina, the athletic programs, just like everything else that resembled any sort of structure, were basically washed away, right?
Yeah, there was nothing going on there. It was a really difficult situation. There was no money for equipment. There was no equipment left. There was, again, you had these kids who were displaced for 2 years. Some played sports, some didn't, some, you know, it really, we were starting. I would actually love to say that we were starting from square one. In fact, we actually had things that were pinning us down during the years that the school wasn't open. They had missed, obviously, they had missed payments on the State Athletic Association regulations and had some old past due fines. So not only did we start from square one, we started about $4,000 or $5,000 in the hole, which was not a fun place to climb out of when you don't have a basketball to dribble or a gym to dribble it in.
So what did you find in the way of both facilities and equipment when you got there? I mean, did you have to deal with mold and mildew, or had all of that already been taken care of by the time you arrived?
So we were in the trailers that were set up post-Katrina. So the trailers were not moldy or anything like that. They were new trailers. However, in terms of equipment, anything that was pretty much salvageable was stolen out of the school or taken by, you know, it was gone. So we started with nothing.
So you're talking literally no pads, no jerseys.
Nothing. Like nothing.
And when you realized that you were in that kind of a situation, well, first of all, you didn't know initially that they were going to ask you to be the basketball coach and athletic director. They asked you to do that after you found out you were going to be a geography teacher, right?
Yeah, so I was pretty much getting it handed to me on a daily basis. I'll be the first to tell you I was not a very good teacher initially. And in August and September of that year, was just really struggling my way through the year and was approached to coach women's basketball. I'm not a basketball. I played a little bit in high school, but I'm not really a basketball player. But for me, it was an opportunity to engage the girls in sports and something productive after schools. And I thought it could pay dividends in the classroom, so I jumped at the opportunity. What happened was, a month later, when we didn't have any facilities, uniforms, or equipment, the athletic director quit, and I was approached at that point to be the athletic director of the school. And in very famous last words, I remember thinking to myself, "How hard can it possibly be?" I soon learned the answer to that question.
And we'll find out more about how Brian Bordenick coped with this situation at George Washington Carver High School in the 9th Ward of New Orleans post-Katrina after we take this brief break. This is MTSU on the Record.
The Concrete Industry Management Program at MTSU fills the need for trained personnel who know concrete technology and techniques. Our alumni go into the marketplace grounded in basic math and science and able to promote products or services related to the industry. Our participation in the Academic Common Market ensures talented students in other states a chance to enroll on an in-state tuition basis. This is Dr. Heather Brown, Director of the program.
To find out more information on this or other university programs, visit mtsunews.com.
Returning now to our conversation with Brian Bordenick, who will be the main speaker at the Tennessee Undergraduate Social Science Symposium here at MTSU on November 1st, talking about his learning curve as a teacher and a coach and an athletic director at George Washington Carver High School in the New Orleans 9th Ward. So confronted with absolutely no materiel, no assistant coaches, and zero money, how did you put your to-do list together about whom to approach for assistance?
Well, you know, internally within the school, we had people who wanted to coach. One of the big issues that we had that first winter was we needed a facility to house us to do basketball. So assembled a list of just places, and, you know, at that time there was a lot of abandoned buildings around us, and one of the buildings that was abandoned around us, or getting back on its feet, was the Desire Street Ministries, which is a building owned by Danny Warfel, who was a quarterback for the Saints, a University of Florida graduate. And they basically told us, "Hey, look, you know, we're not using the gym right now. It's all gutted. The school's gutted. But if you can get insurance on it, like, go ahead and go for it." So, you know, we called up the state who insures the schools, and we brought them down. And, you know, we had to hide some electrical wires and kind of, you know, dust off the place a little bit and just held our breath and hoped that we got the insurance guy to okay it. And once they okayed that, we had a place, and then we went out and started fundraising for equipment and donations for uniforms and things like that, and then kind of rinse, wash, and repeat, right, for every single sport that we did. And basketball is cheap, and track, you can just run in the street, but football is a quite expensive endeavor to take on, and that was where I think a lot of our real challenges happened, was with football, for sure.
But this was like total sweat equity. I mean, you weren't just standing around barking, giving orders. We're talking about mopping floors and cleaning and scrubbing and getting volunteer help to assist you.
Absolutely. I mean, we needed it from all angles. I mean, you name it. We needed doctors to come and screen the kids. We needed, equipment for our coaches. We needed professional development to teach them how to do the things that they did. Buses for transportation. You name it. We needed it. It was kind of a blank, but in a beautiful sense, it was. And I say this now, so take this with a grain of salt. I can kind of almost romanticize about it now because it was a little while ago. At the time, it was very difficult, but in a sense, it was a blank slate for us to kind of create the opportunities that we needed to for ourselves. And granted, it was a very tough situation. However, that being said, it was what as much as we wanted it to be. You know, if we didn't want to do baseball or football or whatever, no one was telling us to do it. So it was kind of on us to take on that responsibility and keep going forward.
So even though it was an uphill climb, you appreciated the autonomy of it. You could create your own athletic department. I mean, it totally had your stamp on it and those of the people you were working with.
Absolutely. Look, what's the expression? The first one through the wall always gets bloody. it was a way to basically create something that you had to be a little crazy when we approached you to help us out. But in doing that, your early adapters, your early believers, your evangelists are some of the best people in the world and people I keep in touch with to this day. The doctor who came down to our school to screen the kids, the first Rotary Club that stroked a check to us to buy uniforms, you know, some of our first NFL athletes that came to help us out. I mean, those are the people that believed in an idea when it was an idea before there was anything to even show for it. And are people who, someone dancing by themselves in the street is a crazy person, but three or four or five or six people gets less crazy with each person. And, those first people who came by our side are just incredible human beings. And in most respects, actually, are actually more important than the original person, which was me.
Well, you had a pro franchise in town, the New Orleans Saints, and now, too, with the Hornets having moved there from Charlotte. Did the pros pitch in and get involved in any way?
Totally. We reached out to Coach Sean Payton, who helped buy some uniforms in conjunction with Drew Brees, which was a huge lift for us, and we were able to leverage their name and their support to bring in other people. We also reached out to a lot of the younger players on the team who are similar in age to me, guys who were making the league minimum to come and help out where they could with their sweat equity instead of their money. And that was really cool to constantly have guys like Usama Young and Jolon Dunbar as a linebacker still for the Saints just around at practice just believing in what we were trying to do.
Now, your first football team, I understand, was only seven people. And then you went and grabbed big boys in the hall and said, "Hey, you're playing football." And they said, "No, I'm not." And you said, "I'm calling your mama."
It's very true. It's quite embarrassing, but it is what it is. One of the hardest moments was after I went around all summer with a couple of friends to a bunch of different Rotary organizations across the Southeast. And we had raised a tremendous amount of money at the time, $25,000, $30,000 to get our athletic football program back off the ground. And then we held our first meeting and no one showed up. We had two kids show up and you're like, "Oh my goodness, here I am running around the whole summer." You'd think we'd have some more people who wanted to be a part of this, and we didn't. So we were like, "Look, if we went out this whole summer and doing all this stuff, we're going to go find some kids, whether we have to pull them out of class or not." And we actually literally pulled them out of class and told them that they were going to come out and play football for us because, on a serious note, and one of the things that was terrible, we've lost kids every year. And those first couple of years, we lost a lot of kids to violent crime. And New Orleans is not a great place, unfortunately, for young people, especially young people without places to go after school. And it's a serious issue. The incarceration rate is insane, and the murder rate is more than that in Chicago, which, if you think about it, Chicago has 4.5 million people. We have 330,000. So it is not okay. And that's what was on the line, and that was kind of the approach that I took with it.
Was the fact that you were all in the same deprived situation a sort of a bonding experience for you and the young people? Would you have been able to get these young African Americans to trust you, a young, well-educated white man, if you all hadn't been in the same situation?
Everyone was really obsessed with, for a while, with, like, the racial thing. And, like, what's it like being, a white guy walking around in a predominantly African-American neighborhood? And, you know, I showed up for work every day. I was, when teachers were calling out sick and people were doing stuff like that, I was there. And when teachers were quitting, I was there. And a couple of years later, you know, I'm still involved in the community. And I think that that was the way to overcome that for me. And I think that there was this definite, like, us versus them. And it wasn't racially divided or age divided. It was, we're in this, doing this thing together. And, and that kind of blended into the overall feeling in the city at the time.
So it was your authenticity and the organic nature of your passion, the fact that you walked the walk as well as talking the talk, that got them on your side. And there was no BS about it. You were there every day. You were doing the work.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that definitely was a large part of it. And the hard part was that you always wanted to do more. You know, when the kids didn't have cleats or they didn't have water bottles or whatever it was, you just always wanted to get it for them. And when they saw you hustling to get whatever they needed to be successful and that you wanted them to be as good as a person from a more affluent school a couple miles up the road, like, I think that did have a huge sense of credibility and add a huge aura of credibility to the project and to what we were trying to do.
When we come back, we'll talk about the Ninth Ward Field of Dreams project. This is MTSU on the Record.
The Middle Tennessee Writing Project is a program that fosters the effective teaching of writing to students in kindergarten through high school. The Writing Project hosts annual summer institutes where teacher participants teach and learn from each other. In addition, the Writing Project sponsors summer writers' camps for youngsters. MTSU is one of 185 sites of the National Writing Project and one of only two in Tennessee. This is Dr. Bobby Solley, Project Director.
For more details, visit mtsunews.com.
Brian Bordenick is our guest today on MTSU on the Record. He'll be speaking at the 20th Annual Tennessee Undergraduate Social Science Symposium on November 1st here at MTSU. Starts at 6 o'clock and is free and open to the public. So now you're trying to raise money, Brian, for a decent football and track field. Tell me about this effort.
One of the things that we uncovered throughout this entire process was that we have a very low participation rate in athletics. And when you couple that with the very high crime rate, it doesn't really take a rocket scientist to figure this out. We're not engaging our kids after school, and as a result, they're getting into bad things, which makes sense. So what we're trying to do is, why is that happening? When you peel back an extra layer and really unbundle the situation, we found the reason why that's happening is because there are no facilities for these kids to go to. So we put it upon ourselves to create a facility. It's a football field and track, stadium seating and lighting, yes. But what it really is, this is a safe place for the kids in the community to go for free. The first place up is kind of New Orleans, and we hope to jumpstart that number of 18% to get it closer to some of the national averages and to help mitigate the really high crime rate amongst kids in New Orleans.
Well, there are a lot of logos on your website. Apparently, you have gotten some corporate support and the business community involved in your efforts, right?
Yeah, pretty much anybody who would listen, we were getting out in front of. We've hit our mark in terms of financial support.
Wow, that is truly amazing. Do you have an exact date for the groundbreaking?
We unfortunately do not, just because of with FEMA stuff and contract bids and all that stuff, it's kind of on a sliding scale. But I will say, at some point this winter.
Did you get the matching grants from NFL Grassroots?
We did. That first grant that we went after was a $200,000 grant that we had 36 days to raise that amount. And we wound up raising by a lot of luck and a lot of really hardworking people and intelligent people. We wound up raising about $339,000 in that first 30 days.
But you knew you had something to really build upon, didn't you, when you had that first junior varsity basketball scrimmage? Because but 500 people showed up for a junior varsity scrimmage, and you're like, holy cow.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we knew we were doing something powerful at that point when when we kind of opened up our doors and really had no idea what to expect. You know, we were working out of an abandoned gym, and we had to manually push out the bleachers on our own, and we just opened up the doors and saw what happened, and the community came out to support, and it's really, you know, I think on the surface, yeah, it's a basketball game. It was the coming together of a community around something that everybody can support, and that was something that was amazing. And when we look at it, like, as an athletic director, I never had a great winning percentage. It's probably one of the worst ever, actually. But it was never really about the game or the sport at all. I mean, I love sports, don't get me wrong, but that's not really what this was about. This was like engaging young people in their lives and engaging older people in their lives as well. And that's what we got really excited about, and that's what we're really proud to be working on, what we're working on.
Are you a former athlete yourself, or was it never your thing? You were a spectator rather than a participant.
I was a big baseball player. I loved sports. Didn't play in college. Played in high school and played football in high school as well. I was a punter, kicker guy in high school. So that was a lot of fun. And I still am always active in sports. But one of the, you know, more interesting things, actually, now that we're talking, I'm reminded of is, you know, for every kid that we had another kid that came out just to, like, hang out with the team. I've never had seen that before in my life. We had, like, you know, that third year, we probably had 55, 60 kids on the team. We probably had 45 managers. and I think that really spoke to the fact that people wanted to be a part of something bigger than themselves, and they wanted to feel safe in our community. And that was a big moment for me.
And ordinarily, a team wouldn't allow 45 managers as just being hangers-on, figuring that they would weigh the team down. But this was a special situation. I mean, they needed something to feel good about, right?
I totally agree. And I think it was about, you know, being someplace where they felt was structured and safe. I mean, when you look at the crime rate and you look at some of the things going on there, I mean, why would you not want to be a part of something that's safe and just good fun? I can't imagine. You know, whether you play football or not, we kept trying to come up with interesting jobs. Like, you take the water bottle to the referee at a timeout, and you take the water bottle to this referee. Everyone had a very specific role.
Do you have enough money for a coaching staff?
I've since left my post as the athletic director of the school and turned over the reins to a successor who hopefully has a better winning percentage than I do. And I'm overseeing the management of this project, and we have some amazing coaches who are doing some amazing things on the ground. Someone told me early on when we founded this nonprofit that the goal of every nonprofit should be to put itself out of business.
Right.
And that's our goal. So I'm slowly phasing myself out. It's actually a great feeling to be the least important person to your organization. It's scary, but it's also amazing. And once we break ground, we have our project managers who will oversee the project, and then they'll be moving into the new school that's being built in conjunction with the field. We'll turn over the keys to that charter school operator. This is a funny story. I was actually approached by our mayor in the city, who said, very cool, nice work with one project. Can you help us figure out the rest of the city? So I've been working to reshape recreation in the city as a whole, which is quite the daunting task.
So you're on the city payroll now.
Yep. And so I'm working, instead of working with children, I'm working on behalf of them. And it is a totally different situation, and definitely miss a lot of the stuff in the classroom. But this is a great opportunity for me to basically spread out the impact across the whole city and see if we can really do something special on a citywide level.
We'll take one more quick break, and we'll be back with Brian Bordenick on MTSU on the Record.
The MTSU Educational Talent Search, or METS, reaches out to students in grades 6 through 12 in Coffee, Grundy, and Warren counties. We provide youngsters who have college potential with educational and financial aid counseling and guide them as they determine their educational and career goals. More than 95% of Educational Talent Search students graduate from high school, and more than 79% enroll in post-secondary education. This is METS Coordinator Debbie Frisbee.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
Brian Bordenick is our guest on MTSU on the Record, and we're talking about the work that he has done for the Ninth Ward Field of Dreams project, helping to build a $1.85 million sports facility in the lower Ninth Ward for George Washington Carver High School. How has your girlfriend reacted to all of this?
She's been a tremendous rock of support, and kind of seen this process kind of unfold from its very early days. And it's actually been a really interesting experience for me to look back through a lot of the initial old emails and, you know, her editing a lot of the stuff that I would send out and really pushing my thinking. And I can definitely honestly say without her support, I don't think any of this is possible.
Were you at any time afraid about living in such a crime-riddled area?
Sometimes, yeah. You know, it's always kind of, it can be, but I can't live my life like that. I've traveled internationally to places that people say you probably shouldn't go, and I don't know. I kind of was living in New York. I grew up in New York during September 11th, you know, so I don't think it's a great way to live. So I just like to, I'm going to keep rolling with the way I do things, be smart and obviously not reckless, but it can be concerning to family members, but for me, I never worried about my safety. I really didn't.
So what kind of a state do we have at George Washington Carver right now with regard to athletics?
The school is being rebuilt by FEMA, but they won't be building the football field and track. So they'll get a brand new school. They will also have two gyms on this new school, an auditorium, and then we'll build an 8-lane synthetic Olympic track, stadium seating and lighting with a you know, full regulation football field that'll be lined for soccer as well. And the beautiful thing is we're just going to open it up and let the community use it when they want it.
Now, in your new job, where the mayor has put you to work for the entire city recreation program, do you have a particular vision now that you've gotten your feet wet and had a chance to sort of inspect the situation?
Yeah, we have a lot of work to do. We've actually worked on really changing a lot of our processes. It's not enough to kind of put Band-Aids on things, and we're really rethinking the way that we deliver recreation to not only to our young people, but to our senior citizens as well. And it is an eye-opening experience every day, and there's a tremendous amount of work to be done, but I feel really great about the space that we're in and the work that we're getting ready, that we're doing. We've created a more transparent recreational department by taking it out of City Hall and creating a public-private partnership, which is really exciting. We've created a separate foundation, which has raised $2 million already to supplement the budget. Double the budget. We've changed the way that we intake programs, the way we evaluate programs. We're running on all cylinders. It's kind of crazy, but it's great.
This is all the more remarkable because your degree at the University of Georgia was not in Parks and Recreation, was it?
No, I was a history major.
What's it like working with Mitchell Andrew?
He's fantastic. He is, you know, as hard as everybody else works, he's the first one there and the last one to leave. So that says something. And just a great consensus builder here in the city. And I think what we need, what we needed at the right time, I wish we had him a couple years earlier than we did.
You're 25, right?
I just turned 26, so I'm getting up there now. Getting up there.
Tell Mitch to look out for you. You'll be running for his job someday, I'm sure.
I hope not.
Brian Bordenick, who headed up the 9th Ward Field of Dreams project and helped to, in his own way, rebuild a little bit of the hurricane-devastated city of New Orleans. Thanks for being our guest today, Brian.
Thank you.
And remember, if you'd like to hear more about Brian's work, attend the 20th Annual Tennessee Undergraduate Social Science Symposium here at MTSU. Brian will be speaking at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, November the 1st, in the Tennessee Room of the James Union Building, and it's free and open to the public.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.